Oh, said he, you go to that house across the street there with the sign, Good Beds for Single Men. That's a good kip, sleeping place. That is. I've been in myself on and off. You'll find it cheap and clean. It was a tall, battered-looking house, with dim lights in all the windows, some of which were patched with brown paper. I entered a stone passageway, and a small, etiolated boy with sleepy eyes appeared from a door leading to a cellar. Murmurous sounds came from the cellar, and a wave of hot air and cheese. The boy yawned and held out his hand. "Want a kip? That'll be all, Governor." I paid the shilling, and the boy led me up a rickety, unlighted staircase to a bedroom. It had a sweetish reek of paregoric and foul linen. The windows seemed to be tight shut, and the air was almost suffocating at first. There was a candle burning, and I saw that the room measured 15 feet square by 8 high, and had 8 beds in it. Already 6 lodgers were in bed, queer, lumpy shapes, with all their own clothes, even their boots, piled on top of them. Someone was coughing in a loathsome manner in one corner. When I got into the bed, I found that it was as hard as a board, and as for the pillow, it was a mere hard cylinder like a block of wood. It was rather worse than sleeping on a table, because the bed was not 6 feet long and very narrow, and the mattress was convex, so that one had to hold on to avoid falling out. The sheets stank so horribly of sweat that I couldn't bear them near my nose. Also, the bedclothes only consisted of the sheets and a cotton counterpane, so that, though stuffy, it was none too warm. Several noises recurred throughout the night. About once in an hour, the man on my left, a sailor, I think, woke up, swore vilely, and lighted a cigarette. Another man, victim of a bladder disease, got up and noisily used his chamber pot 6 times during the night. The man in the corner had a coughing fit once in every 20 minutes, so regularly that one came to listen for it as one listens for the next yap when a dog is baying the moon. It was an unspeakably repellent sound, a foul bubbling and retching as though the man's bowels were being churned up within him. Once, when he struck a match, I saw that he was a very old man, with a grey, sunken face like that of a corpse, and he was wearing his trousers wrapped round his head as a nightcap, a thing which for some reason disgusted me very much. Every time he coughed, or the other man swore, a sleepy voice from one of the other beds cried out, "Shut up! Oh, for Christ's fucking sake, shut up!" I had about an hour's sleep in all. In the morning I was woken by a dim impression of some large brown thing coming towards me. I opened my eyes and saw that it was one of the sailor's feet sticking out of bed close to my face. It was dark brown, quite dark brown, like an Indian's, with dirt. The walls were leprous, and the sheets, 3 weeks from the wash, were almost raw umber colour. I got up, dressed, and went downstairs. In the cellar were a row of basins and 2 slippery roller towels. I had a piece of soap in my pocket, and I was going to wash, when I noticed that every basin was streaked with grime, solid, sticky filth as black as boot blacking. I went out unwashed. Altogether, the lodging house had not come up to its description as cheap and clean. It was, however, as I found later, a fairly representative lodging house. I crossed the river and walked a long way eastward, finally going into a coffee shop on Tower Hill. An ordinary London coffee shop, like 1,000 others, it seemed queer and foreign after Paris. It was a little stuffy room with the high-backed pews that were fashionable in the 40s, the day's menu written on a mirror with a piece of soap, and a girl of 14 handling the dishes. Navvies were eating out of newspaper parcels and drinking tea in vast saucerless mugs like china tumblers. In a corner by himself, a Jew, muzzled down in the plate, was guiltily wolfing bacon. "Could I have some tea and bread and butter?" I said to the girl. She stared. "No butter, only Marge," she said, surprised, and she repeated the order, in the phrase that is to London what the eternal coup de rouge is to Paris. "Large tea and 2 slices." On the wall beside my pew there was a notice saying, "Pocketing the sugar not allowed," and beneath it some poetic customer had written, "He that takes away the sugar shall be called a dirty bugger," but someone else had been at pains to scratch out the last word. This was England. The tea and two slices cost threepence halfpenny, leaving me with eight and tuppence. Chapter 25. The 8 shillings lasted 3 days and 4 nights. After my bad experience in the Waterloo Road, it is a curious but well-known fact that bugs are much commoner in South than North London. For some reason, they have not yet crossed the river in any great numbers. I moved eastward and spent the next night in a lodging house in Pennyfields. This was a typical lodging house, like scores of others in London. It had accommodation for between 50 and 100 men and was managed by a deputy. A deputy for the owner, that is, for these lodging houses are profitable concerns and are owned by rich men. We slept 15 or 20 in a dormitory. The beds were again cold and hard, but the sheets were not more than a week from the wash, which was an improvement. The charge was 9 pence or 1 shilling. In the shilling dormitory, the beds were 6 feet apart instead of 4, and the terms were cash down by 7 in the evening or out you went. Downstairs, there was a kitchen common to all lodgers, with free firing and a supply of cooking pots, tea basins and toasting forks. There were 2 great clinker fires, which were kept burning day and night the year through. The work of tending the fires, sweeping the kitchen and making the beds, was done by the lodgers in rotation. One senior lodger, a fine Norman-looking stevedore named Steve, was known as head of the house and was arbiter of disputes and unpaid chucker-out. I liked the kitchen. It was a low-ceiled cellar, deep underground, very hot and drowsy with coke fumes, and lighted only by the fires, which cast black velvet shadows in the corners. Ragged washing hung on strings from the ceiling. Red-lit men, stevedores mostly, moved about the fires with cooking pots. Some of them were quite naked, for they had been laundering and were waiting for their clothes to dry. At night, there were games of nap and draughts and songs. I'm a Chap What's Done Wrong by My Parents was a favourite, and so was another popular song about a shipwreck. Sometimes, late at night, men would come in with a pail of winkles they'd bought cheap and share them out. There was a general sharing of food, and it was taken for granted to feed men who were out of work. A little pale, wizened creature, obviously dying, referred to as Poor Brown, been under the doctor and cut open 3 times, was regularly fed by the others. 2 or 3 of the lodgers were old-age pensioners. Till meeting them, I had never realised that there are people in England who live on nothing but the old-age pension of 10 shillings a week. None of these old men had any other resource whatever. One of them was talkative, and I asked him how he managed to exist. He said, "Well, there's 9 pence a night for your kip. That's 5 and 3 pence a week. Then there's 3 pence on Saturday for a shave. That's 5 and 6. Then say you has a haircut once a month for 6 pence. That's another 3 pence a week. So you has about 4 and 4 pence for food and bacca." He could imagine no other expenses. His food was bread and margarine and tea. Towards the end of the week, dry bread and tea without milk, and perhaps he got his clothes from charity. He seemed contented, valuing his bed and fire more than food, but with an income of 10 shillings a week to spend money on a shave, it's awe-inspiring. All day I loafed in the streets, east as far as Wapping, west as far as Whitechapel. It was queer after Paris. Everything was so much cleaner and quieter and drearier. One missed the scream of the trams and the noisy, festering life of the back streets and the armed men clattering through the squares. The crowds were better dressed, and the faces comelier and milder and more alike, without that fierce individuality and malice of the French. There was less drunkenness and less dirt and less quarrelling, and more idling. Knots of men stood at all the corners, slightly underfed, but kept going by the tea and two slices, which the Londoner swallows every 2 hours. One seemed to breathe a less feverish air than in Paris. It was the land of the tea urn and the labour exchange, as Paris is the land of the bistro and the sweatshop. It was interesting to watch the crowds. The East London women are pretty. It's the mixture of blood, perhaps. And Limehouse was sprinkled with Orientals. Chinamen, Chittagonian Lascars, Dravidians selling silk scarves, even a few Sikhs, come goodness knows how. Here and there were street meetings. In Whitechapel, somebody called the Singing Evangel undertook to save you from hell for the charge of sixpence. In the East India Dock Road, the Salvation Army were holding a service. They were singing Anybody Here Like Sneaking Judas to the tune of What's to be Done with a Drunken Sailor. On Tower Hill, two Mormons were trying to address a meeting. Round their platform struggled a mob of men shouting and interrupting. Someone was denouncing them for polygamists. A lame, bearded man, evidently an atheist, had heard the word God and was heckling angrily. There was a confused uproar of voices. My dear friends, if you would only let us finish what we were saying. That's right, give him a say, don't get any argue. No, no, you answer me. Can you show me God? You show him me, then I'll believe in him. Oh, shut up, don't keep interrupting of them. Interrupt yourself, polygamists. Well, there's a lot to be said for polygamy. Take the fucking women out of industry anyway. My dear friends, if you would just... No, no, don't you slip out of it. Have you seen God? Have you touched him? Have you shook hands with him? Oh, don't get any argue, for Christ's sake, don't get any argue. Etc., etc. I listened for 20 minutes, anxious to learn something about Mormonism, but the meeting never got beyond shouts. It's the general fate of street meetings. In Middlesex Street, among the crowds at the market, a draggled, down-at-heel woman was hauling a brat of 5 by the arm. She brandished a tin trumpet in its face. The brat was squalling. "Enjoy yourself!" yelled the mother. "What you think I brought you out here for and bought you a trumpet and all? Do you want to go across my knee? You little bastard, you shall enjoy yourself!" Some drops of spittle fell from the trumpet. The mother and the child disappeared, both bawling. It was all very queer after Paris. The last night that I was in the Pennyfields lodging house, there was a quarrel between two of the lodgers. A vile scene. One of the old-age pensioners, a man of about 70, naked to the waist, he'd been laundering, was violently abusing a short, thick-set stevedore who stood with his back to the fire. I could see the old man's face in the light of the fire, and he was almost crying with grief and rage. Evidently something very serious had happened. The old-age pensioner. "You shit!" the stevedore. "Shut your mouth, you old cunt, before I set about you." The old-age pensioner. "Just you try it on, you shit. I'm 30 years older than you, but it wouldn't take much to make me give you one as a knock you into a bucket full of piss." The stevedore. "Oh, and then perhaps I wouldn't smash you up after, you old cunt." Thus for 5 minutes. The lodgers sat around, unhappy, trying to disregard the quarrel. The stevedore looked sullen, but the old man was growing more and more furious. He kept making little rushes at the other, sticking out his face and screaming from a few inches distant like a cat on a wall and spitting. He was trying to nerve himself to strike a blow, and not quite succeeding. Finally he burst out, "Arsehole! That's what you are! A fucking arsehole! Take down your dirty gob and suck it, you can! By Christ, I'll smash you before I've done with you! Arsehole, that's what you are, you son of a fucking whore! Lick that, you cunt, that's what I think of you, you cunt, you prick, you shit, you black bastard!" Whereat he suddenly collapsed on a bench, took his face in his hands, and began crying. The other man, seeing that public feeling was against him, went out. Afterwards I heard Steve explaining the cause of the quarrel. It seemed that it was all about a shilling's worth of food. In some way the old man had lost his store of bread and margarine, and so would have nothing to eat for the next 3 days except what the others gave him in charity. The stevedore, who was in work and well-fed, had taunted him. Hence the quarrel. When my money was down to 1 4-pence, I went for a night to a lodging house in Bow, where the charge was only 8 pence. One went down an area and through an alleyway into a deep, stifling cellar 10 feet square. 10 men, navvies mostly, were sitting in the deep glare of the fire. It was midnight, but the deputy's son, a pale, sticky child of 5, was there playing on the navvy's knees. An old Irishman was whistling to a blind bullfinch in a tiny cage. There were other songbirds there. Tiny, faded things that had lived all their lives underground. The lodgers habitually made water in the fire to save going across a yard to the lavatory. As I sat at the table, I felt something stir near my feet, and looking down, saw a wave of black things moving slowly across the floor. They were black beetles. There were 6 beds in the dormitory, and the sheets, marked in huge letters, stolen from number whatever road, smelt loathsome. In the next bed to me lay a very old man, a pavement artist, with some extraordinary curvature of the spine that made him stick right out of bed, with his back a foot or two from my face. It was bare and marked with curious swirls of dirt like a marble tabletop. During the night, a man came in drunk and was sick on the floor close to my bed. There were bugs, too. Not so bad as in Paris, but enough to keep one awake. It was a filthy place. Yet the deputy and his wife were friendly people, and ready to make one a cup of tea at any hour of the day or night. Chapter 26. In the morning, after paying for the usual tea and 2 slices, and buying 1/2 ounce of tobacco, I had 1/2 left. I didn't care to ask B for more money yet, so there was nothing for it but to go to a casual ward. I had very little idea how to set about this, but I knew that there was a casual ward at Rompton, so I walked out there, arriving at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. Leaning against the pig pens in Rompton Marketplace was a wizened old Irishman, obviously a tramp. I went and leaned beside him, and presently offered him my tobacco box. He opened the box and looked at the tobacco in astonishment. "By God," he said, "there's 6 pence at the good baccy here. Where the hell did you get hold of that? You ain't been on the road long."
"What, don't you have tobacco on the road?" I said.
"Oh, we have it. Look."
He produced a rusty tin, which had once held Oxo cubes. In it were 20 or 30 cigarette ends picked up from the pavement. The Irishman said that he rarely got any other tobacco. He added that, with care, one could collect 2 ounces of tobacco a day on the London pavements.
"Do you come out of one of the London spikes?"
"Casual wards, eh?" he asked me. I said yes, thinking this would make him accept me as a fellow tramp, and asked him what the spike at Rompton was like.
He said, "Well, 'tis the cocoa spike. There's tay spikes, and cocoa spikes, and skilly spikes. They don't give you skilly in Rompton, thank God. Leastways, they didn't the last time I was here. I've been up to York and round Wales since."
"What is skilly?" I said.
"Skilly? A can of hot water with some bloody oatmeal at the bottom, that's skilly. The skilly spikes is always the worst."
We stayed talking for an hour or two. The Irishman was a friendly old man, but he smelt very unpleasant, which was not surprising when one learned how many diseases he suffered from. It appeared, he described his symptoms fully, that taking him from top to bottom, he had the following things wrong with him. On his crown, which was bald, he had eczema. He was short-sighted and had no glasses. He had chronic bronchitis. He had some undiagnosed pain in the back. He had dyspepsia. He had urethritis, he had varicose veins, bunions, and flat feet. With this assemblage of diseases, he had tramped the roads for 15 years. At about 5, the Irishman said, "Could you do with a cup of tea? The spike don't open till 6.
"I should think I could. "Well, there's a place here where they gives you a free cup of tea and a bun. Good tea, it is. They makes you say a lot of bloody prayers after, but hell, it all passes the time away. You come with me."
He led the way to a small tin-roofed shed in a side street, rather like a village cricket pavilion. About 25 other tramps were waiting. A few of them were dirty old habitual vagabonds, the majority decent-looking lads from the north, probably miners or cotton operatives out of work. Presently the door opened, and a lady in a blue silk dress, wearing gold spectacles and a crucifix, welcomed us in. Inside were 30 or 40 hard chairs, a harmonium, and a very gory lithograph of the crucifixion. Uncomfortably, we took off our caps and sat down. The lady handed out the tea, and while we ate and drank, she moved to and fro, talking benignly. She talked upon religious subjects, about Jesus Christ always having a soft spot for poor rough men like us, and about how quickly the time passed when you were in church, and what a difference it made to a man on the road if he said his prayers regularly. We hated it, We sat against the wall, fingering our caps. A tramp feels indecently exposed with his cap off, and turning pink and trying to mumble something when the lady addressed us. There was no doubt that she meant it all kindly. As she came up to one of the North Country lads with the plate of buns, she said to him, "And you, my boy, how long is it since you knelt down and spoke with your father in heaven?" Poor lad, not a word could he utter, but his belly answered for him with a disgraceful rumbling which it set up at the sight of the food. Thereafter he was so overcome with shame that he could scarcely swallow his bun. Only one man managed to answer the lady in her own style, and he was a spry, red-nosed fellow, looking like a corporal who had lost his stripe for drunkenness. He could pronounce the words, "The dear Lord Jesus," with less shame than anyone I ever saw. No doubt he'd learned the knack in prison. Tea ended, and I saw the tramps looking furtively at one another. An unspoken thought was running from man to man. Could we possibly make off before the prayers started? Someone stirred in his chair, not getting up, actually, but with just a glance at the door, as though half suggesting the idea of departure. The lady quelled him with one look. She said in a more benign tone than ever, "I don't think you need go quite yet. The casual ward doesn't open till 6, and we have time to kneel down and say a few words to our father first. I think we should all feel better after that, shouldn't we?" The red-nosed man was very helpful, pulling the harmonium into place and handing out the prayer box. His back was to the lady as he did this, and it was his idea of a joke to deal the books like a pack of cards, whispering to each man as he did so, "There you are, mate. There's a fucking nap hanging for you, 4 aces and a king," etc. Bareheaded, we knelt down among the dirty teacups and began to mumble that we had left undone those things that we ought to have done, and done those things that we ought not to have done, and there was no health in us. The lady prayed very fervently, but her eyes roved over us all the time, making sure that we were attending. When she wasn't looking, we grinned and winked at one another and whispered bawdy jokes just to show that we didn't care. But it stuck in our throats a little. No one except the red-nosed man was self-possessed enough to speak the responses above a whisper. We got on better with the singing, except that one old tramp knew no tune but "Onward, Christian Soldiers," and reverted to it sometimes, spoiling the harmony. The prayers lasted half an hour. And then, after a handshake at the door, we made off. "Well," said somebody as soon as we were out of hearing, "the trouble's over. I thought them fucking prayers was never going to end." "You had your bun," said another. "You got to pay for it." "Pray for it, you mean? Ah, you don't get much for nothing. They can't even give you a tuppenny cup of tea without you go down your fucking knees for it." There were murmurs of agreement. Evidently the tramps were not grateful for their tea. And yet it was excellent tea, as different from coffee-shop tea as good Bordeaux is from the muck called colonial claret, and we were all glad of it. I'm sure, too, that it was given in a good spirit, without any intention of humiliating us. So, in fairness, we ought to have been grateful. Still, we were not. Chapter 27. At about 5:45, the Irishman led me to the Spike. It was a grim, smoky yellow cube of brick, standing in a corner of the workhouse grounds. With its rows of tiny barred windows and a high wall and iron gates separating it from the road, it looked much like a prison. Already a long queue of ragged men had formed up, waiting for the gates to open. They were of all kinds and ages. The youngest, a fresh-faced boy of 16, the oldest, a doubled-up, toothless mummy of 75. Some were hardened tramps, recognisable by their sticks and billies and dust-darkened faces. Some were factory hands out of work, some agricultural labourers, one a clerk in collar and tie, two certainly imbeciles. Seen in the mass, lounging there, they were a disgusting sight. Nothing villainous or dangerous, but a graceless, mangy crew, nearly all ragged and palpably underfed. They were friendly, however, and asked no questions. Many offered me tobacco. Cigarette ends, that is. We leaned against the wall, smoking, and the tramps began to talk about the spikes they'd been in recently. It appeared from what they said that all spikes are different, each with its peculiar merits and demerits, and it is important to know these when you're on the road. An old hand will tell you the peculiarities of every spike in England, as at A, you are allowed to smoke, but there are bugs in the cells. At B, the beds are comfortable, but the porter is a bully. At C, they let you out early in the morning, but the tea is undrinkable. At D, the officials steal your money if you have any. And so on interminably. There are regular beaten tracks where the spikes are within a day's march of one another. I was told that the Barnets and Albans route is the best, and they warned me to steer clear of Billericay and Chelmsford, also Ide Hill in Kent. Chelsea was said to be the most luxurious spike in England. Someone praising it said that the blankets there were more like prison than the spike. Tramps go far afield in summer, and in winter they circle as much as possible round the large towns, where it's warmer and there's more charity. But they have to keep moving, for you may not enter any one spike, or any two London spikes, more than once in a month, on pain of being confined for a week. Sometime after six, the gates opened, and we began to file in one at a time. In the yard was an office, where an official entered in a ledger our names and trades and ages, also the places we were coming from and going to. This last is intended to keep a check on the movements of tramps. I gave my trade as painter. I painted watercolours. Who's not? The official also asked us whether we had any money, and every man said no. It is against the law to enter the spike with more than eightpence. And any sum less than this, one is supposed to hand over at the gate. But as a rule, the tramps prefer to smuggle their money in, tying it tight in a piece of cloth so that it will not chink. Generally, they put it in the bag of tea and sugar that every tramp carries, or among their papers. The papers are considered sacred and are never searched. After registering at the office, we were led into the spike by an official known as the Tramp Major. His job is to supervise casuals, and he is generally a workhouse pauper, and a great, bawling ruffian of a porter in a blue uniform who treated us like cattle. The spike consisted simply of a bathroom and lavatory, and for the rest, long double rows of stone cells, perhaps 100 cells in all. It was a bare, gloomy place of stone and whitewash, unwillingly clean, with a smell which somehow I had foreseen from its appearance, a smell of soft soap, jay's fluid and latrines, a cold, discouraging, prisonish smell. The porter herded us all into the passage, and then told us to come into the bathroom six at a time to be searched before bathing. The search was for money and tobacco, Rompton being one of those spikes where you can smoke once you've smuggled your tobacco in, but it will be confiscated if it is found on you. The old hands had told us that the porter never searched below the knee, so before going in, we'd all hidden our tobacco in the ankles of our boots. Afterwards, while undressing, we slipped it into our coats, which we were allowed to keep to serve as pillows. The scene in the bathroom was extraordinarily repulsive. 50 dirty, stark naked men, elbowing each other in a room 20 feet square, with only two bathtubs and two slimy roller towels between them all. I shall never forget the reek of dirty feet. Less than half the tramps actually bathed. I heard them saying that hot water is weakening to the system, but they all washed their faces and feet, and the horrid, greasy little clouts known as toe rags, which they bind round their toes. Fresh water was only allowed for men who were having a complete bath, so many men had to bathe in water where others had washed their feet. The porter shoved us to and fro, giving the rough side of his tongue when anyone wasted time. When my turn came from the bath, I asked if I might swill out the tub, which was streaked with dirt, before using it. He answered simply, "Shut your fucking mouth and get on with your bath." That set the social tone of the place, and I didn't speak again. When we had finished bathing, the porter tied our clothes in bundles and gave us workhouse shirts, grey cotton things of doubtful cleanliness, like abbreviated nightgowns. We were sent along to the cells at once, and presently the porter and the tramp major brought our supper across from the workhouse. Each man's ration was a half-pound wedge of bread smeared with margarine and a pint of bitter, sugarless cocoa in a tin billy. Sitting on the floor, we wolfed this in 5 minutes, and at about 7 o'clock the cell doors were locked on the outside to remain locked till 8 in the morning. Each man was allowed to sleep with his mate, the cells being intended to hold 2 men apiece. I had no mate, and was put in with another solitary man, a thin, scrubby-faced fellow with a slight squint. The cell measured 8 feet by 5 by 8 high, was made of stone, and had a tiny barred window high up in the wall and a spy hole in the door, just like a cell in a prison. In it were 6 blankets, a chamber pot, a hot water pipe, and nothing else whatever. I looked round the cell with a vague feeling that there was something missing. Then, with a shock of surprise, I realised what it was and exclaimed, "But I say, damn it, where are the beds?" "Beds?" said the other man, surprised. "There are no beds. What do you expect? This is one of them spikes where you sleep on a floor. Christ, had you got used to that yet?" It appeared that no beds was quite a normal condition in the spike. We rolled up our coats and put them against the hot water pipe and made ourselves as comfortable as we could. It grew foully stuffy, but it wasn't warm enough to allow of our putting all the blankets underneath, so that we could only use one to soften the floor. We lay a foot apart, breathing into one another's face, with our naked limbs constantly touching and rolling against one another whenever we fell asleep. One fidgeted from side to side, but it didn't do much good. Whichever way one turned, there would be first a dull, numb feeling, then a sharp ache as the hardness of the floor wore through the blanket. One could sleep, but not for more than 10 minutes on end. About midnight, the other man began making homosexual attempts upon me. A nasty experience in a locked, pitch-dark cell. He was a feeble creature, and I could manage him easily. But, of course, it was impossible to go to sleep again. For the rest of the night, we stayed awake, smoking and talking. The man told me the story of his life. He was a fitter, out of work for 3 years. He said that his wife had promptly deserted him when he lost his job, and he'd been so long away from women that he'd almost forgotten what they were like. Homosexuality is general among tramps of long standing, he said. At 8, the porter came along the passage, unlocking the doors and shouting, "All out!" The doors opened, letting out a stale, fetid stink. At once the passage was full of squalid, grey-shirted figures, each chamber pot in hand scrambling for the bathroom. It appeared that in the morning only 1 tub of water was allowed for the lot of us, and when I arrived 20 tramps had already washed their faces. I took 1 glance at the black scum floating on the water and went unwashed. After this, we were given a breakfast identical with the previous night's supper, our clothes were returned to us, and we were ordered out into the yard to work. The work was peeling potatoes for the pauper's dinner, but it was a mere formality to keep us occupied until the doctor came to inspect us. Most of the tramps frankly idled. The doctor turned up at about 10 o'clock, and we were told to go back to our cells, strip, and wait in the passage for inspection. Naked and shivering, we lined up in the passage. You cannot conceive what ruinous, degenerate curs we looked, standing there in the merciless morning light. A tramp's clothes are bad, but they conceal far worse things. To see him as he really is, unmitigated, you must see him naked. Flat feet, pot bellies, hollow chests, sagging muscles, every kind of physical rottenness was there. Nearly everyone was undernourished, and some clearly diseased. 2 men were wearing trusses, and as for the old mummy-like creature of 75, one wondered how he could possibly make his daily march. Looking at our faces, unshaven and creased from the sleepless night, you would have thought that all of us were recovering from a week on the drink. The inspection was designed merely to detect smallpox, and took no notice of our general condition. A young medical student, smoking a cigarette, walked rapidly along the line, glancing us up and down, and not inquiring whether any man was well or ill. When my cell companion stripped, I saw that his chest was covered with a red rash, and having spent the night a few inches away from him, I fell into a panic about smallpox. The doctor, however, examined the rash and said that it was due merely to undernourishment. After the inspection, we dressed and were sent into the yard, where the porter called our names over, gave us back any possessions we had left at the office, and distributed meal tickets. These were worth sixpence each, and were directed to coffee shops on the route we had named the night before. It was interesting to see that quite a number of the tramps couldn't read, and had to apply to myself and other scholards to decipher their tickets. The gates were opened, and we dispersed immediately. How sweet the air does smell, even the air of a back street in the suburbs, after the shut-in, sub-fecal stench of the spike. I had a mate now, for while we were peeling potatoes, I had made friends with an Irish tramp named Paddy Jakes, a melancholy pale man who seemed clean and decent. He was going to Edbury Spike, and suggested that we should go together. We set out, getting there at 3 in the afternoon. It was a 12-mile walk, but we made it 14 by getting lost among the desolate North London slums. Our meal tickets were directed to a coffee shop in Ilford. When we got there, the little chit of a serving maid, having seen our tickets and grasped that we were tramps, tossed her head in contempt and for a long time wouldn't serve us. Finally, she slapped on the table 2 large teas and 4 slices of bread and dripping. That is, 8 pennyworth of food. It appeared that the shop habitually cheated the tramps of 2d or so on each ticket. Having tickets instead of money, the tramps could not protest or go elsewhere.
This ends Disc 4. Down and Out in Paris and London. Disc 5.
Chapter 28. Paddy was my mate for about the next fortnight. And as he was the first tramp I had known at all well, I want to give an account of him. I believe that he was a typical tramp, and there are tens of thousands in England like him. He was a tallish man, aged about 35, with fair hair going grizzled and watery blue eyes. His features were good, but his cheeks had lanked and had that greyish, dirty-in-the-grain look that comes of a bread-and-margarine diet. He was dressed, rather better than most tramps, in a tweed shooting jacket and a pair of old evening trousers with the braid still on them. Evidently the braid figured in his mind as a lingering scrap of respectability, and he took care to sew it on again when it came loose. He was careful of his appearance altogether, and carried a razor and boot brush that he would not sell, though he had sold his papers and even his pocket knife long since. Nevertheless, one would have known him for a tramp 100 yards away. There was something in his drifting style of walk, and the way he had of hunching his shoulders forward, essentially abject. Seeing him walk, you felt instinctively that he would sooner take a blow than give one. He had been brought up in Ireland, served 2 years in the war, and then worked in a metal polish factory, where he had lost his job 2 years earlier. He was horribly ashamed of being a tramp, but he had picked up all a tramp's ways. He browsed the pavements unceasingly, never missing a cigarette end or even an empty cigarette packet, as he used the tissue paper for rolling cigarettes. On our way into Edbury, he saw a newspaper parcel on the pavement, pounced on it, and found that it contained 2 mutton sandwiches, rather frayed at the edges. These he insisted on my sharing. He never passed an automatic machine without giving a tug at the handle, for he said that sometimes they're out of order and will eject pennies if you tug at them. He had no stomach for crime, however. When we were in the outskirts of Rompton, Paddy noticed a bottle of milk on a doorstep, evidently left there by mistake. He stopped, eyeing the bottle hungrily. "Christ," he said, "there's good food going to waste. Somebody could knock that bottle off, eh? Knock it off easy." I saw that he was thinking of knocking it off himself. He looked up and down the street. It was a quiet, residential street, and there was nobody in sight. Paddy's sickly, chapfallen face yearned over the milk. Then he turned away, saying gloomily, "Best leave it. It don't do a man no good to steal. Thank God I ain't never stolen nothing yet." It was funk, bread of hunger, that kept him virtuous. With only 2 or 3 sound meals in his belly, he would have found courage to steal the milk. He had 2 subjects of conversation: the shame and come down of being a tramp, and the best way of getting a free meal. As we drifted through the streets, he would keep up a monologue in this style, in a whimpering, self-pitying Irish voice. "It's hell being on the road, eh? It breaks your heart going into them bloody spikes. But what's a man to do else, eh? I ain't had a good meat meal for about 2 months, and me boots is getting back, and Christ, how would it be if we was to try for a cup of tea at one of them convents on the way to Edbury? Most times they're good for a cup of tea. And what did a man do without religion, eh? I've took cups of tea from the convents and the Baptists and the Church of England and all sorts. I'm a Catholic myself. That's to say I ain't been to confession for about 17 year, but still I got me religious feelings, you understand. And them convents is always good for a cup of tea, etc., etc. He would keep this up all day, almost without stopping. His ignorance was limitless and appalling. He once asked me, for instance, whether Napoleon lived before Jesus Christ or after. Another time, when I was looking into a bookshop window, he grew very perturbed because one of the books was called Of the Imitation of Christ. He took this for blasphemy. What the hell did they want to go imitating of him for? He demanded angrily. He could read, but he had a kind of loathing for books. On our way from Rompton to Edbury, I went into a public library, and though Paddy didn't want to read, I suggested that he should come in and rest his legs. But he preferred to wait on the pavement. No, he said, the sight of all that bloody print makes me sick. Like most tramps, he was passionately mean about matches. He had a box of matches when I met him, but I never saw him strike one, and he used to lecture me for extravagance when I struck mine. His method was to cadge a light from strangers, sometimes going without a smoke for half an hour rather than strike a match. Self-pity was the clue to his character. The thought of his bad luck never seemed to leave him for an instant. He would break long silences to exclaim, apropos of nothing, "It's hell when your clothes begin to go up the spout, eh?" Or, "That tay in the spike ain't tay, it's piss." As though there was nothing else in the world to think about. And he had a low, worm-like envy of anyone who was better off. Not of the rich, for they were beyond his social horizon, but of men in work. He pined for work as an artist pines to be famous. If he saw an old man working, he would say bitterly, "Look at that old fucker keeping able-bodied men out of work." Or if it was a boy, "It's them young divils what's taking the bread out of our mouths." And all foreigners were them bloody Dagos. For, according to his theory, foreigners were responsible for unemployment. He looked at women with a mixture of longing and hatred. Young, pretty women were too much above him to enter into his ideas, but his mouth watered at prostitutes. A couple of scarlet-lipped old creatures would go past. Paddy's face would flush pale pink, and he would turn and stare hungrily after the women. "Tarts," he would murmur, like a boy at a sweet shop window. He told me once that he hadn't had to do with a woman for 2 years, since he'd lost his job, that is, and he had forgotten that one could aim higher than prostitutes. He had the regular character of a tramp, abject, envious, a jackal's character. Nevertheless, he was a good fellow, generous by nature, and capable of sharing his last crust with a friend. Indeed, he did literally share his last crust with me more than once. He was probably capable of work too, if he'd been well fed for a few months. But 2 years of bread and margarine had lowered his standards hopelessly. He had lived on this filthy imitation of food till his own mind and body were compounded of inferior stuff. It was malnutrition, and not any native vice, that had destroyed his manhood. Chapter 29. On the way to Edbury, I told Paddy that I had a friend from whom I could be sure of getting money, and suggested going straight into London rather than face another night in the Spike. But Paddy hadn't been in Edbury Spike recently, and tramp-like, he wouldn't waste a night's free lodging. We arranged to go into London the next morning. I had only a halfpenny, but Paddy had 2 shillings, which would get us a bed each and a few cups of tea. The Edbury Spike didn't differ much from the one at Rompton. The worst feature was that all tobacco was confiscated at the gate, and we were warned that any man caught smoking would be turned out at once. Under the Vagrancy Act, tramps can be prosecuted for smoking in the Spike. In fact, they can be prosecuted for almost anything. But the authorities generally save the trouble of a prosecution by turning disobedient men out of doors. There was no work to do, and the cells were fairly comfortable. We slept 2 in a cell, 1 up, 1 down, That is, one on a wooden shelf and one on the floor, with straw palliasses and plenty of blankets. Dirty, but not verminous. The food was the same as at Rompton, except that we had tea instead of cocoa. One could get extra tea in the morning, as the tramp major was selling it at a halfpenny a mug, illicitly, no doubt. We were each given a hunk of bread and cheese to take away for our midday meal. When we got into London, we had 8 hours to kill before the lodging houses opened. It's curious how one doesn't notice things. I'd been in London innumerable times, and yet till that day I had never noticed one of the worst things about London. The fact that it costs money even to sit down. In Paris, if you had no money and could not find a public bench, you would sit on the pavement. Heaven knows what sitting on the pavement would lead to in London. Prison, probably. By four, we had stood 5 hours, and our feet seemed red hot from the hardness of the stones. We were hungry, having eaten our ration as soon as we left the spike, and I was out of tobacco. It mattered less to Paddy, who picked up cigarette ends. We tried two churches and found them locked. Then we tried a public library, but there were no seats in it. As a last hope, Paddy suggested trying a Rowton House. By the rules, they wouldn't let us in before seven, but we might slip in unnoticed. We walked up to the magnificent doorway. The Rowton Houses really are magnificent. And very casually, trying to look like regular lodgers, began to stroll in. Instantly, a man lounging in the doorway, a sharp-faced fellow, evidently in some position of authority, barred the way. "You men sleep here last night?" "Nope. Then fuck off." We obeyed and stood 2 more hours on the street corner. It was unpleasant, but it taught me not to use the expression street corner loafer, so I gained something from it. At 6, we went to a Salvation Army shelter. We couldn't book beds till 8, and it was not certain that there would be any vacant, but an official, who called us brother, let us in on the condition that we paid for 2 cups of tea. The main hall of the shelter was a great whitewashed barn of a place, oppressively clean and bare, with no fires. 200 decentish, rather subdued-looking people were sitting packed on long wooden benches. One or two officers in uniform prowled up and down. On the wall were pictures of General Booth and notices prohibiting cooking, drinking, spitting, swearing, quarrelling and gambling. As a specimen of these notices, here is one that I copied word for word. "Any man found gambling or playing cards will be expelled and will not be admitted under any circumstances.